return from recess.
The second matter on our docket today is People of the State of Colorado against Tellus. Council seated at table are on that case. And inasmuch as both council have experience with the Colorado Court of Appeals, you're aware of the procedures, and with that, you may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Doyle Baker. I'm the deputy district attorney from Colorado Springs. I represent the people in this appeal. My bar registration number is 22277. This appeal presents the court with two issues. One has been raised by the defendant and goes to the jurisdiction of the court to hear the appeal. The second concerns the merits of the appeal itself that we have taken. And I'd like to address the jurisdiction issue first. Boiled down, that issue is very simple. If the trial judge in Colorado Springs dismissed all of the counts against the defendant at the end of the preliminary hearing, this was a final order, and under the court's rules, we have 45 days to file a notice of appeal. If, however, the judge dismissed some but not all of the charges against the defendant, we have an order that's not final, it's interlocutory. And under the court's rules, we have 10 days in which to file our notice of appeal. We met the 45-day deadline. If the 10-day deadline applies, we concede that we are out of time. And to understand exactly what kind of order this is, you have to look at the proceedings that occurred at the preliminary hearing. And at the end of that hearing, defense counsel asked the judge for one of two things. First, he asked for the charges to be dismissed. In the alternative, he asked that the defendant's bond be reduced and that the case be set for further proceedings in the future. And the judge's response is telling, and it's dispositive of this issue. The judge said, "I am dismissing the charges." And that was the end of it. Nothing was set forth or set forward on his docket at a later date. The case was concluded. It was final. And under those circumstances, what we have here, that was an order that was final and gave us 45 days to file our appeal. We met that deadline, and therefore, jurisdiction is proper with the court, and we would ask you to consider the merits of our appeal, which I will turn to now. In this case, there's evidence on both sides. We presented evidence as to the identity of the robber, and we presented it through the testimony of two witnesses at the preliminary hearing. And that evidence, summarized and viewed in the light most favorable to us, indicates that when the robber entered this Burger King where the robbery occurred, the night manager looked at him and immediately called him by the defendant's first name. We know that the night manager of this Burger King knew the defendant both socially, lived across the street from him, and met him at parties, and also from work. They had worked together at this Burger King. The night manager identified the defendant to the police, picked him out of a photo lineup, and she also identified him at the preliminary hearing as the individual who was the robber, and stated, I believe, that she was 95% certain of her identification.
Mr. Baker, what if the identifying witness is not credible?
Well, the credibility issue, Your Honor, is a matter that the jury decides under the case law that has been established in this jurisdiction. And certainly there are arguments that can be made about this victim's or this manager's credibility and why she's not credible. And the trial judge latched on to those. And, you know, on the one hand, you have the evidence that I just mentioned supporting the conclusion that we have the person who committed this robbery and is properly charged. On the other hand, you have evidence which shows that when the victim was first contacted by the police, she told them she didn't know who the robber was. And later on, she admitted, well, she was scared. She gave varying descriptions of the robber's eye color. And at the preliminary hearing, she said his eyes were blue. And when she was instructed by the court to look at the defendant, she noted the eyes were brown.
Excuse me, Mr. Baker. The Colorado Supreme Court has frequently referred to a preliminary hearing as a screening device. And it would seem to me that there must be some need for a trial court holding this sort of hearing to do some sort of weighing of credibility, or else, you know, how can it serve its function as a way to filter out cases that are unworthy for trial, completely unworthy?
Your Honor, I guess I'm forced to disagree with you on that part. I think that if we had no evidence that pointed to this defendant being the robber, we didn't have the evidence of the manager calling him by his name when she saw him right away. We didn't have the circumstantial evidence that we have, which indicates that at about 4:30 in the morning, when it just happened that the money was being counted back in the office, that a knock came at the door and surprised someone came in and it was a robber. If we didn't have these things that pointed to the fact that the manager did know the defendant and that the defendant may very well have had inside information about how this Burger King operated, we didn't have any evidence at all that pointed to him as the robber, then the judge would have been proper in his conclusion that there was not enough evidence to bind the defendant over on the charges. But what we have here is we have serious conflict in evidence. And if you look at the case law that I've cited, including Supreme Court cases, they talk about testimony from eyewitnesses is going to be inherently conflicting and inconsistent, and it should not be up to a judge at a preliminary hearing to resolve those inconsistencies. If there's a problem with the evidence in that regard, we leave it to the jury to sort all that out. And this is simply not a case where, viewed in the light most favorable to us, there's no evidence to meet the probable cause standard. There is. And the judge gave lip service to the proper standard in his ruling, but where he got into trouble was he actually started weighing the evidence. And if you look at the conclusion of the hearing, what he said, he focused on the problems with the victim's ID. She got his eye color wrong, she recanted at the hearing, and he ignored all of the other evidence that weighed on the other side.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Baker. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the Walker case.
Yes.
And I understand why you're relying quite heavily on that case, because the identification testimony in that case was quite similar in amount and type to what we have in this case. But in Walker, wasn't there quite a bit of other evidence connected the defendant, I mean, truly connected him to the crime, such as the found in the location of the red shirt that the robber was wearing? And in fact, there were cashier's checks with the same serial numbers as those taken from the store, and we don't have that kind of bulk of evidence in this case.
Well, we certainly have different types of evidence in this case, and I think that the one thing that Walker is, that's close in Walker to this case, is the defendant, as I recall, in Walker was charged with robbery, like the defendant here, and the witnesses to the actual robbery gave conflicting identification and were hesitant to identify the robber and couldn't do so strongly. You certainly have circumstantial evidence that he was the robber based on those things that you just mentioned. A couple days later, the police find him in a car with some gentlemen who were trying to get these checks cashed. None of that could directly place this person at the scene. in some ways, I think the evidence here is actually stronger than in Walker. First thing out of the night manager's mouth when she sees this gunman is the defendant's first name.
Which was a fairly common first name.
It is a fairly common first name, but still, to say it and perhaps just get lucky, you know, it's a remarkable coincidence. We also know something about this defendant. We know that he was familiar with this Burger King and familiar with the way things worked. And who else is going to show up at 4:30 in the morning at the back door of this Burger King when the daily procedure for rebanking these cash registers is occurring, but somebody who knows something about how this restaurant operates? So it's not like we've got an entire universe out there from whom we're trying to identify this suspect. Now, as I've said, certainly contrary evidence exists here. And the judge latched onto that in making his ruling, but that was not the judge's role here. Judge was to look at the evidence, and he was to look at it in the light most favorable to us, not weigh it, leave that responsibility for the jury, and make a finding of PC. We believe that the judge went beyond what his role was in this case, and therefore we're asking that you reverse this finding of no probable cause, and that you remand this case with instructions that we hold a trial.
You've got 4 minutes and 29 seconds, Mr. Baker.
Good morning. My name is Ryan Hartman, registration number 37922, appearing on behalf of MT, the defendant and appellee in this case. This morning, I intend to address both issues in my answer brief. First, this court lacks jurisdiction to consider the merits of this appeal. If a party files an appeal after a certain deadline, this court lacks jurisdiction or cannot hear this case. The rule in Colorado is that after a preliminary hearing, if the judge dismisses some but not all charges against a defendant, the DA has 10 days within which to appeal. Here, the DA's appealed more than 30 days after dismissal of some but not all charges against MT. In Colorado, criminal defendants accused of certain felonies are entitled to a preliminary hearing. Misdemeanors are beyond the scope of the preliminary hearing. Here, MT was charged with 5 felonies and 1 misdemeanor. At the conclusion of the preliminary hearing, the court stated, "I'm going to find that the people have not shown probable cause, and I'm going to order MT to be released on these charges, and I'm going to dismiss these charges without prejudice." The court must have been referring to those charges properly before him, the felony charges, and not the misdemeanor. Even if the court did intend to dismiss the misdemeanor, it could not have done so, and did so in error, because the misdemeanor was not before him at that time. Thus, the misdemeanor remains pending and is left to be tried. If the prosecution wanted to proceed on the misdemeanor, it should have said to the court, "Hey, would you please set the misdemeanor over?" It could have done so, and it did not. When the court dismisses some but not all charges against a criminal defendant, the prosecution must appeal within 10 days. This rule is jurisdictional. Here, the DA appealed more than 30 days after dismissal of some but not all charges. Thus, this appeal is untimely. This court lacks jurisdiction to consider its merits, and the appeal must be dismissed.
In this case, though, didn't the court purport to dismiss the misdemeanor as well?
Minute orders say that the misdemeanor was dismissed, but even if the court did intend to do so, it did so in error. It should not have, and could not have, because the misdemeanor was not before the court at that time.
Well, certainly the court, being a district court, had jurisdiction over the misdemeanor as part of that case, didn't it?
But preliminary hearings are not intended to address felony charges. In fact, they're only intended to address F1, 2, and 3, and only 4, 5, and 6 if it meets a certain other qualifications, like the defendant being in custody. The misdemeanors are beyond the scope of the preliminary hearing.
I understand that, but nonetheless, the district court had jurisdiction over that misdemeanor.
Over the misdemeanor, yes, but it was not before the court at the preliminary hearing. If the court has no more questions about the first issue, I will move on to the second. The district court did not abuse its discretion in dismissing charges against MT after the preliminary hearing. Like People versus Collins, this is merely the DA's dispute over the sufficiency of evidence presented at the preliminary hearing. This case presents no question of law, and the court did not misinterpret any statute or any statutory term. Here, the court noted and applied the correct legal standard. It stated that it viewed the evidence in the light most favorable to the people. Thus, abuse of discretion review applies. The purpose of a preliminary hearing is to screen out groundless cases. It also serves to protect the accused from degradation and expense of criminal trial, and it serves to promote judicial economy and efficiency. These objectives are undermined if the appellate court second guesses the discretionary first-hand assessment of the trial court.
Ms. Hardman, I want to follow up on something that Mr. Baker was talking about with respect to the judge's role as a gatekeeper, if you will. Isn't the judge's role different in a preliminary hearing than it is in a trial? And what I mean by that is that leave aside for the moment this notion that the jury gets to decide everything and focus instead upon the judge's role as a gatekeeper. In a trial, it might be possible for the judge to say, this witness is incredible as a matter of law. But can a judge say that in a preliminary hearing, particularly where you've got at least these things? The witness knew the defendant. The witness lived across the street from the defendant and had been to parties in the defendant's home. The witness worked with the defendant at the restaurant. And on the basis of the first three, the witness called him Mike, even though he had a mask on at the time of the robbery. Even if everything else is disputed, and there is a tremendous conflict in the evidence, which will never get past a jury at trial, doesn't the judge have an obligation to bind this over for probable cause?
It's the judge's role at the preliminary hearing to determine whether the people have established probable cause. Probable cause is evidence sufficient to induce a person of ordinary caution to entertain a reasonable belief that the accused committed the charged offense. Here, what the trial court had was an alleged victim whose only basis for her identification was the robber's eyes, because the robber's face was entirely covered from his eyes up and his nose down. She only saw the robber's eyes. She said she did not base her identification on voice, did not recognize his clothes. She said that she originally thought it was Mike, but then later realized when he turned around, it was not. She only identified MT as the robber after the detective told her that she was a suspect of the crime. The people did not call any other victims. There were three other people there at the Burger King. Did not ask any of those other people if they could identify the robber. And here you have a victim who by the end of the preliminary hearing is unsure whether MT was the robber. This is not a case where the court is weighing evidence as you see in many of the other preliminary hearing cases. This is not where two different witnesses testify and say, oh, I think it was him. Oh, I don't think it was. And the judge weighs and the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court says that's an abuse of discretion. Here you have one victim testifying and saying, I thought it was him and now I'm not sure. So it's not the judge weighing evidence. The judge determined that that evidence was not sufficient to induce a person of ordinary caution to entertain a reasonable belief that MT committed these robberies.
In spite of all these inconsistencies that you've described, the fact remains that at one point this victim identified the defendant from a lineup and said that that was the robber. Now, I understand that there's credibility issues, but she did say that, and viewed in the light most favorable to the prosecution, isn't that simply enough to establish identity?
Not when this person later is saying, well, no, I don't think so. The robber's eyes were blue. Oh, yeah, MT's eyes are brown.
Well, I said viewed in the light most favorable to the prosecution, isn't that enough in spite of the inconsistencies that she identified?
No, you have one victim who is completely unsure by the end of the preliminary hearing that does not establish probable cause.
So your position is that the victim's testimony at the preliminary hearing should be given some greater priority than statements that she made before the preliminary hearing?
I know what I was trying to respond to before. The fact that she picked him out of a photo lineup means very little because she already knows him. She knows who MT is.
But she said he was the robber.
Only after the DA said, or the detective says, well, we think you are the suspect. Originally she says, no, it wasn't him. And she goes back and forth. That is not enough to establish probable cause.
Pardon me, Ms. Hardman, but aren't we talking essentially here about a credibility determination for that one witness, which is in essence no different than if there had been two witnesses who had given the conflicting stories? The various weights of her various components of her testimony, different time, different substance, I'm less sure now, I'm not sure, all that is clearly within a jury's province to weigh. But unless the court says, under the proper standard, that this victim was incredible as a matter of law at the time the victim identified him as the robber, hasn't the trial court engaged in a credibility weighing?
I don't think so, because the probable cause standard is not carte blanche for the DA to present anything and get to trial on it. They must present, what I keep quoting, evidence sufficient to induce a person of ordinary caution, presumably the judge is a person of ordinary caution, to entertain a reasonable belief that MT committed these robberies. And here you have a victim who, that would not induce a person of ordinary caution to believe that MT committed the charged offense.
But don't sometimes people, when they come into court, perform less well than they've performed out of court? They're nervous, they're unsure, perhaps they're afraid. And all these are the kinds of issues that may play into a different level of being sure at a preliminary hearing. And once again, all those things are relevant for trial, but this is a preliminary hearing.
On a cold record, we can't tell how this victim performed at the preliminary hearing. And I don't think it's our job to second guess the discretionary first-hand assessment of the trial court in this.
Which is a credibility determination, right?
He has to determine probable cause, and here he determined there was no probable cause. This is not a case where the court weighed conflicting evidence. Also, this court did not overlook circumstantial evidence. The circumstantial evidence in this case is extremely weak. The fact that he supposedly responded to the name Mike means very little when she's sitting there counting her money and she yells out anything. She could have yelled out, hey, Judge Bernard, and Robert would have turned around and looked to see who was making noise or who else was there at the Burger King. There was no evidence of what hours MT worked or how familiar he was with the Burger King procedures. There was no evidence of how many other employees worked there or how they might have been might have worked at that time. And there was no evidence that she used a different name, like, hey, Chuck, and he didn't turn around, but only turned around when called Mike. The only evidence presented was that the robber's eyes of her identification was that the robber's eyes were blue and the robber's eyes were brown. Unless the court has any more questions, we would request that this court dismiss the appeal or alternatively affirm the district court's order dismissing felony charges against MT. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hardman. Mr. Baker?
The only tool available to a lawyer, any lawyer, including a judge, is words. It's the only way we can make ourselves clear and convey our meaning to others. And therefore, what's said, as well as what is not said, becomes of utmost importance. In this case, at the end of the preliminary hearing, the judge said, I'm dismissing the charges, period, end of sentence. Case at that point was closed in its entirety, and therefore we had a final order, and our appeal was brought within the time for appealing the final order. Turning back to the merits of this case, certainly this preliminary hearing did not end the way that we would have hoped it would have, but as was pointed out in some of the questions to Ms. Hardman, there are a myriad of explanations for why this victim, this night manager, this Burger King, changed her testimony. It's clear both from her statements to the police and her testimony at the preliminary hearing that she was scared. She was scared of the defendant. She didn't want to be there. And if she truly believed that this was the man who came into that Burger King, put a gun to her head and demanded money, when she was ordered by the court to look into his eyes, and she realized that she got the color wrong, it's not inconceivable that she would have changed her mind. She may have also changed her mind because she felt that she'd been made to look foolish on cross-examination by defense counsel, and she didn't see how she could continue to state what she truly believed. There are a number of ways that this evidence can be argued.
Mr. Baker, I understand that there's reasons why the victim might not have testified well at the preliminary hearing, but the DA nevertheless has to produce something, and like Ms. Hardman said, the DA can't, if they produce just anything, what's the point of having a preliminary hearing? Don't they have to produce some case of sufficient quality to move forward?
We do, and in this case, Your Honor, we did. We have an identification on more than one instance by the night manager. And certainly there, again, we get back to the credibility issue. There's evidence on both sides. And the trial judge recognized that he was to give us every benefit of the doubt. And after he stated the appropriate legal standard, he went out and he dismissed all the cases based on, when you read what he said in the transcript, the fact that the victim recanted at the hearing and that she got the eye color wrong at the hearing. These are credibility issues. And these are things that we at least deserve a shot in front of the jury for. We didn't get that, and so we're here today and we're asking you to reverse that decision. And unless Your Honors have any more questions, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Thanks again, Ms. Hardman. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That will complete our docket, and the bailiff may announce a recess.